On this week's 51%, grooming women for political office continues. A mother shares her struggle with postpartum depression in a graphic way.
I really feel like society puts a lot of pressure on new mothers to be perfect and to view motherhood as this very happy and joyful time.
And a researcher on gerontology says loneliness negatively impacts health. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Different organizations, from national to local, have programs to groom women for political office. An effort in Berkshire County, Massachusetts is underway to show women the ins and outs of what it means to run for political office. 51%'s Josh Landes explored a campaign bootcamp 101 training from the Berkshire chapter of the Massachusetts Women's Political Caucus.
There's a statistic that doesn't sit right with Helen Moon.
In Massachusetts, we have 28.5% of women that is part of the Massachusetts state legislature. That is not acceptable, especially considering we pride ourselves on being a state that is first in everything. You know, we were first in gay marriage. We had Obamacare before Obamacare, you know. So we're really proud on being on the progressive cutting edge. And yet, in terms of equity in politics, we're not even close.
Moon is one of the co-presidents of the Berkshire's chapter of the Massachusetts Women's Political Caucus. Its mission?
Recruit, train, and elect women in and around Berkshire County.
The group was founded by Amy Diamond and now Berkshire County District Attorney Andrea Harrington after the 2016 election. This year, it's introducing its first annual Campaign Bootcamp 101 event.
It includes messaging, having the right message to deliver to the right crowd at the right time all the time. It also includes a management portion. Campaigns are not run in isolation. You need a team and a team of volunteers. So how do you engage volunteers to join your team and stay on your team? And, of course, money. Unfortunately, money rules politics. So how do you raise money? How do you report what you're raising? So kind of the campaign finance portion of it.
The training's last component is about mobilization.
That's your field, knocking on doors, phone banking, and a GOTV section, which is get out the vote.
Moon knows a lot about the realities of running for office as a woman. She's currently preparing her campaign for a second term as Pittsfield's Ward 1 city councilor.
What we hear a lot is you're not qualified. What experiences do you have that make you qualified? And I feel like women are put in a place where you're not judged for the capacity that you could achieve. You're not judged on your potential, but you're judged on the lack of what people in power or people who are influential say is the right experience.
Moon says that gatekeeping is particularly hard on women.
A lot of women are, they're still impacted by being at home raising their families. And so you may not have the relevant experience to run for office, but that home life experience is also incredibly relevant and should not keep somebody from running for office. So I think we need to change the dialogue around what is a qualifier for running for office. We are residents contributing to this community. That makes me qualified to run for office.
You know, if you look at many elected offices, the next one up, the candidates that take over that office and ultimately win were mentored by their predecessors. So for women, we don't necessarily have that opportunity.
Dina Guiel-Lampiazzi runs the group alongside Moon. She ran unsuccessfully for Pittsfield's Ward 2 City Council seat in 2017 and is now running for Ward 6, whose councilor isn't seeking another term.
when we look at, you know, what does it mean to recruit? It's this event. It's asking women that have even considered running for office to show up, come and learn what it's about. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they will be the candidates. Maybe they will be the fundraisers. Maybe the women that attend this training will be the campaign managers or the social media managers, all of the different jobs that a campaign can possibly have.
Moon says the MWPC's larger mission isn't just about winning elections. It's about making women a part of a political culture that has excluded them for too long.
It's about moving our country and our state and our local politics to a place where we're no longer talking about whether we're losing seats, because if a woman does not get elected, we have one less woman on the city council. It's about looking at the city council. Maybe one day it'll be all women.
For 51%, I'm Josh Landes.
And there's been more grooming women for political office in Connecticut. In its 25th year, the Women's Campaign School at Yale, a nonpartisan and issue-neutral political campaign leadership program, was holding its 5-day intensive summer session this June, bringing 80 women from various sectors and partisan backgrounds together in training for elected and appointed office. The program has been attended by such women as U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat from New York and 2020 presidential candidate, along with former Congresswoman Elizabeth Estey of Connecticut. Next, we meet Yolanda. She's a DACA student at Humboldt State University in California, and she worries about being able to finish her schooling.
Pase lo que pase, la vida continúa.
Immigrant Voices, documenting the undocumented.
Pase lo que pase, la vida continúa.
Hello, my name is Yolanda. I was born in Tlaxcala, Mexico. And I am an HSC student majoring in math with two minors in computer science and Spanish. This is my third year here, and I am a DACA recipient. I migrated to the United States when I was 1.5. My parents brought me here, and they actually left me with a family member, one of my uncles and my aunt. And while they spent time crossing the border, it took them 2 weeks. My mom was actually detained twice, and my dad was waiting for her the second time that she got detained. He had to sleep outside in a bench. They were very discouraged. They felt they had no money. They felt like they just couldn't make it, and they called my uncle and said, you know what, can you bring my daughter back? Because we're just going to head back to Mexico, to our town, and stay there. And my uncle said, you can't give up. And the third time they were actually able to cross after my mom almost died of hypothermia in the desert. And growing up, I knew I was an undocumented student my entire life, but I didn't really know what that meant. I was able to go to Mexico and visit my family, my grandma and my grandpa. I wanted to go back a couple years later, but my mom said that I couldn't, that things were risky, and I didn't know what that meant. I saw all my cousins go to Mexico and have fun and see the rest of my family, and I always wondered why I couldn't go. Once I got to high school and the college process, the applications and financial aid came along, it was really hard for me to go through that because I was very discouraged. People told me, like, oh, if you don't have a social security number, then you're not going to be able to go to college or get a diploma or work, get loans. Like, how are your parents going to afford college for you? So it was very discouraging, but I was able to go to a school that really supported me through that process. I met an immigration attorney who helped myself and the other DACA recipients in my high school go through that and find scholarships. And even though scholarships are really hard to find because once you apply for them, you know, you look at the requirements, and there's always that U.S. citizen requirement.
Immigrant Voices is a Flobo production through the studios of KHSU. Find the full story at khsu.org.
A mother who struggled with postpartum depression has expressed her journey in a graphic memoir. That mother is 42-year-old Teresa Wong, and her memoir is called Dear Scarlet, The Story of My Postpartum Depression. Wong wrote and illustrated the story of her struggle as a letter to her first child, Scarlet, and offers reassurance to other mothers affected by postpartum depression that they are not alone. 51%'s Elizabeth Hill spoke with Wong about her experience as a first-time mother and the various remedies she sought for her postpartum depression.
I think I knew I had postpartum depression probably shortly after I left the hospital, actually, but it was so soon after Scarlett's birth that the doctor I went to see when she was 10 days old kind of shrugged it off as the baby blues. And so I know there's a real fine line between just being kind of extremely emotional and easily upset after having a baby, because there are a whole bunch of hormones kind of coursing through your body, between that and actually having depression. And so her suggestion was just to go for more walks outside and get more sun. But I knew there was something deeper going on. I just did not feel like myself.
So what made you decide to write a graphic memoir? Was that something you were writing during your pregnancy?
No, I was actually pregnant with my third child, my son Isaac, at the time. And I was trying to go to sleep at night. It was early on in his pregnancy, and having lots of trouble just getting comfortable. And I would think back to when I was pregnant with Scarlett and then her delivery, and those images that flashed back in my mind were very vivid and still very close to the surface. And so it would make me cry. When I just remembered that time, I realized I wasn't completely done with it, and I really wanted to get that story kind of out of me and onto paper. Even though I'd had a lot of counseling and treatment through both my bouts of postpartum depression, I just felt like writing it down would be the closure that I needed. So after my son was born, and for a whole year after that, after he turned one, I finally found the time to sit down and write it out.
I'm curious, why a graphic memoir? Are you an artist?
I'm not an artist. I'm actually a writer and very beginner illustrator. I felt like the story needed to be a graphic, mainly because of all those images that flashed back in my head at that time, but also because new motherhood is a really silent time in a woman's life, and I hadn't really figured out how to talk to my baby in those first few months, and so I would just sit in silence with her a lot, and or rock her on the exercise ball, or, you know, feed her in silence. And so I felt like a graphic would be the best way to convey that silent time. And so when I decided it would be a graphic memoir, I sketched it out as a storyboard, thinking that I would show it to an illustrator friend of mine and basically collaborate with him on the finished book. But he gave it back to me and said, you know, I think that the vulnerability of the story kind of matches with the shakiness of your lines and kind of the naivety of your drawings. And so he felt that it would be more personal and a better story if it was both written and drawn by me.
Are there parts of your heritage and maybe how your parents would have dealt with postpartum? Did you find that there was dissonance between the remedy that you sought and what was historically done?
Yeah, I am Chinese Canadian, and so I was born in Canada to Chinese immigrants, and I followed some of the Chinese traditions around the postpartum period, which means that I spent a month at home without going out and without taking the baby out, and my mom came to take care of me, and she was very concerned about my physical health, and so most Chinese remedies are focused on that. And so she would make me different kinds of soups, or I guess some people would call them elixirs, with different types of medicinal ingredients and herbal remedies to help my body recover from the labor and delivery. But we never really talked about my mental health. I don't even know if there's an acknowledgement of a postpartum depression in Chinese culture. I, you know, there might be, but we certainly never discussed it.
It sounds like with Scarlett, it was a little bit of an isolation. You said that you stay in your house with your child mm-hmm. for like a month. Did mm-hmm. you do that with all three of your children?
I actually did do that with all three of my children. It's kind of like a blessing and a curse, because having a baby and going through labor and delivery is a big deal. And so I liked having the option of staying at home and not feeling the need or pressure to go out and kind of bounce right back. And, you know, especially to have my mom with me making all my meals and taking care of me as well as the baby. But the second and third time, I just made a more conscious effort to invite people over and to have more community time, but just inside my home.
Yeah. Did you suffer from postpartum during pregnancy and after pregnancy mm-hmm. with Isaac?
No, I didn't. So with Isaac, I was seeing a counselor during my pregnancy, just kind of checking in with her every few months to make sure that my mood was okay. And then a little bit shortly after he was born as well. And I feel like that kind of preventive measure really helped a lot. And then, you know, I like to tell this story of the day I brought Isaac home, and it was in the middle of the night, and I'd gotten barely any sleep, and I was feeding him, nursing him in his room, and I looked down at him, and I just was flooded with all these emotions of, like, I was just so proud of him and proud to have him in my arms and so happy, and I thought, hey, wait a minute, this is what a lot of other mothers must feel when they have babies. And it's strange, but it took me three kids to get to that feeling.
Your daughters are now 9 and 8. Do you know when you will broach the subject of this book and maybe open up about your journey with them?
I have already, in a little way. Both my daughters have read my book. Actually, Scarlett read it before I even had it published. You know, at this point, I don't think they understand the depth of what I felt. But at this point, I just explained to them that I was very sad and very scared when they were babies, and that made me upset. But luckily, I was able to get the help that I needed, and it didn't make me love them any less. It just meant that I was new at being a mother, and I needed some extra help.
What advice do you have for new mothers?
I think the main thing is that I really feel like society puts a lot of pressure on new mothers to be perfect and to view motherhood as this very happy and joyful time, and that if you feel any other feelings like loneliness or guilt or regret, that brings a lot of shame into your life, and you don't feel like you can talk about those feelings. And so my biggest piece of advice is to express how you feel, to tell someone you trust if you are having a hard time, and to let people help you.
That was author Teresa Wong speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her graphic memoir, Dear Scarlett, The Story of My Postpartum Depression. In America, doctors can be criticized for doing too much, like running extra tests or scheduling too many follow-up appointments. But in many parts of the developing world, doctors are stretched thin and cutting corners. Now, a team of U.S. researchers thinks it has found a way to motivate doctors in the developing world to keep their patients healthier, and it could hold a bigger message about how societies deliver health care. Carol Jackson of the Ways and Means podcast explains.
Sunitha Prabhu is a gynecologist practicing in a small town outside of Bangalore, India, called Malore. She's been delivering babies here for 15 years.
New life. There's nothing more joyful than that, delivering a life. I just love that.
But one thing she doesn't love is that many women here don't come to the doctor during their entire pregnancies. They can't afford it, so they simply show up when the baby is due. Dr. Prabhu says in her first year of practice, she delivered a baby for a woman she had never met before.
So, okay, delivery was normal, fine. She delivered a baby, was fine. But, see, she started bleeding like hell. And bleeding heavily, we have all the chances of losing her.
This excessive bleeding is called postpartum hemorrhage. It's the largest cause of maternal mortality in the developing world. Duke University professor Manoj Mohanan thinks many of these deaths can be prevented by addressing what's called the no-do gap. Doctors in this part of the world know more than they actually do.
It exists because there are little incentives in the existing marketplace for them to do everything that they know, because effort is costly. Doing the right thing, even though we know it needs to be done, can be really costly. And so eventually, as human beings, people start cutting corners.
So Mohanan and collaborators from Harvard, Stanford, and University College London decided to look at what economic incentives can be used to prevent women from hemorrhaging and dying in childbirth.
The simplest form of incentive for individuals is money. At the end of the day, we all work for something in life. Most of us have some higher calling, but money helps.
Mohanan specifically studied whether money is best spent getting doctors to rigidly follow rules and procedures, or to have them focus on the best health outcome, regardless of their process. In essence, do you reward the input or the output? To test this, the input group was told to follow all the researchers' instructions explicitly.
The document covers everything that needs to be done for a mother from the time she comes in for her first antenatal care checkup during her first trimester, all the way until she delivers the baby and goes home. And there's a long list, and the doctor is supposed to do all of these things.
The output group had freedom to use their own judgment as long as mothers and babies were healthy in the end. At the end of the 2-year study, the researchers found that rewarding doctors for health outcomes did make a difference. In fact, both the input and the output groups had similar results. Nearly 20% fewer women hemorrhaged or died than in the control group. And there was another insight. Doctors who were more experienced performed better when outputs were incentivized and they were free to use their own judgment. This study is the first to empirically compare inputs and outputs in this way. Mohanan was speaking with the Indian government and says the lessons can be applied immediately. For the Ways and Means podcast, I'm Carol Jackson.
Ways and Means is a research podcast from the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Loneliness in older adults can lead to serious health problems, and this is especially an issue in rural America, where seniors may be more isolated. Senior centers were created to combat this problem, but they face challenges of their own. Side Effects Public Media's Lisa Gillespie reports from Casey County, southeast of Louisville, Kentucky.
It's lunchtime at the local senior center, which is right down the street from a 1950s-era movie theater and a flower shop. A band is wrapping up their last set. There are tables set for jigsaw puzzles and another for card games. This is where 83-year-old Glenn Emerson is sitting, playing the card game Rummy with his friends.
Gene's been here from the beginning.
The senior center is a big part of his life. He comes here just about every day to socialize and eat a low-cost meal. Emerson is a gregarious character, but he wasn't always this way. In 2003, his wife of 42 years died.
I had a couple of bad years after I lost my wife. It was kind of bad, you know. Yeah, I got depressed and lost weight.
It was around that time he started going to the senior center and met his current girlfriend.
Did you imagine that you were going to have a girlfriend again?
No, not for the first couple of years. I wasn't too much interested. And then after I got to feeling better, the women started looking good again.
Tommy Allen, the director of the senior center, says these kinds of matches happen all the time.
They hear about someone that might be here, and they'll come and strike up a conversation, and the next thing you know, they'll start a little romance. It happens a lot.
The centers are places for socialization, protecting people from loneliness. And loneliness can lead an older adult on a rapid path of physical and mental deterioration.
There's kind of this statistic out there now that being lonely, it's as much of a risk factor as smoking 15 cigarettes a day in terms of mortality.
That's Melissa Cannon, who teaches and researches aging at Western Oregon University.
Our rural communities are aging, and a lot of families have kind of left behind their older loved ones.
That means more older people living alone, which can lead to sharp cognitive decline. They might forget to take medication, forget to eat, and give up other activities that keep them healthy. Greg Powell sees this firsthand in his work as a minister at local Mount Olive Christian Church.
There's people that I go see, they want to visit that bad that they'll walk out the door and walk you all the way to the car. That's how much that they want to visit. So that's lonely. That's a picture of loneliness.
So you'd think people would be flocking to the senior center, but Director Tommy Allen says enrollment is declining. That's in part because of the nature of the senior center. Eventually, members will die.
By the end of the day, we will have buried two of our seniors.
That's coupled with a reluctance from baby boomers who don't think senior centers are for them.
We offer different activities to try to reach different interests. But so many people anymore, they don't want to come because they're not a senior. And they think this is a place for old people.
Cannon at Western Oregon University says dwindling membership at these centers is a nationwide problem.
And that's been creating some challenges for them. It's hard for them to justify getting more funding from the government when their numbers are decreasing. But at the same time, they're still serving a population that very much needs them to exist. They're still providing those essential services.
Allen is considering changing the name to attract baby boomers. In rural Kentucky, where rates of chronic illnesses are among the highest in the country, these centers can be a literal lifesaver. It has been for Emerson, who retired in his 60s. He remembers some advice he got from a coworker before retiring.
She said, are we going to retire, Glenn? I said, yeah. She said, well, let me tell you something. She said, don't go home and get on the couch and die. So I didn't. So I've been moving.
Yeah.
I've been moving ever since, 21 years.
I'm Lisa Gillespie for Side Effects Public Media in Louisville.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1561.